In 1874, the British government passed a series of laws called the Regulation of Public Worship.
What?
A lot of people cared an awful lot about church back then.
True.
On one side, people wanted more ritual and ceremony.
Order.
On the other side, they wanted mostly none.
Yeah.
In the midst of the battle, one minister, a rector in London at a church called St. George in the East, had stopped a practice whereby people who volunteered in church services could avail themselves of liquor from the rector's cupboard before and after the service. The Reverend King closed the cupboard. We have opened it again. Welcome to the rector's cupboard.
Order!
While we're pleased to be joined by Quentin Jennis, who is author of the recent book, Recovering People, Addiction, Personhood, and the Life of the Church. Dr. Quentin Jennis is an emergency physician and ethicist at St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver, Canada. He serves as the physician ethicist for Providence Healthcare and is a sessional faculty and the professional in residence at Regent College in Vancouver, where he teaches on topics including medical ethics and addiction. Dr. Jennis, thank you for joining us. Great to have you here.
Yes, welcome. It's very nice to meet you. Do you mind if we call you Quentin for the interview? Or
I would prefer that.
You would prefer that? Okay.
Well, thank you so much for being here. There's a lot of things that we're excited to talk about. But first, we'd like to know a little bit about you, what your background is, some of your interests, why you wrote the book that we're going to be talking about. So yeah, tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Sure. I'm originally an Alberta boy, so I grew up just outside Edmonton, big family, lots of siblings and cousins, and spent most of my life in Alberta. Went to undergrad at the King's University and
med school.
Yes, yes. Oh, okay,
fantastic.
I'm familiar. Okay.
Yeah, we know some profs and stuff from there. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, I have. King's is a big part of my story.
Okay.
Yeah, I loved going to King's, and I went to med school at U of A, and then I took a year off of med school and did a master's degree in theology at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. That's a whole story.
I was going to say, I'm not sure that that's a normative sort of path for most doctors, is it?
No. and this is, again, my love and affection for King's. I went to undergrad, thinking I was a sort of a pure science-y guy, and I just wanted to take enough biochem to get into med school. And King's, as you probably know, is a liberal arts undergrad mm-hmm. approach, and so they make you, even if you want to be a narrow science-y guy, they make you study history and philosophy and literature. And at that stage in my life, I thought, how dare they make me study these other width and breadth subjects? But those years at King's, they totally changed my life. And I had some lovely professors who saw things in me that I did not see in myself. And I really fell in love with the humanities, and most specifically theology. And then I went to med school, and I liked med school, but I missed reading Dostoevsky. I missed reading history. And one of my professors, my theology professors from King's, I was just chatting to him one day, and sometime in the first couple years of med school, and he said, yeah, you should just take an academic leave of absence and go to Scotland and do a master's degree. And I did. So that was a wonderful gift in my life. At the time I was at St. Andrews, Tom Wright was there and John Webster was there and studied with a number of other really amazing theologians, people who loved God with their minds and did theology as a way of loving God with their minds, which I found to be very compelling.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back to Canada, finished med school and residency and an additional year of enhanced skills training after residency. And now I'm an emergency physician. That's sort of my day job or my first job. so I work mostly at St. Paul's Hospital, mostly very early morning shifts, 4 a.m. Uh-huh. usually.
Wow.
At St. Paul's. So that's sort of my first job. But outside of my clinical work, I have a number of other non-clinical interests. I do quite a bit of teaching, including at Regent. And when I'm not doing those things, I've got 4 kids and love planting, growing flowers and vegetables with my kids and going to the park with them. We live just near Trout Lake Park here in Vancouver.
Nice.
So we love the farmer's market and going and playing soccer in the field there.
Your story, like, it's certainly different. I think we've mentioned in a previous conversation we had the book When Breath Becomes Air, Paul Kalanithi, because he did something similar. I mean, it wasn't a theology degree when he went, maybe not. And he went to do like a literature degree over in the UK or something, right? So you do this, and this is kind of worlds coming together for you, theology and medicine. But you came back, there was never for you a sense that you'd stay in the theological field and not the medicine field. Was that a possibility?
Yeah, it was a possibility. And I was very angsty about my own vocation and future for a long, long time, and really, really struggled. I had a thought that, you know, I had these two very different interests or two very different side of myself. There was a part of me that was and is a science-y guy, loved learning about physiology and anatomy and that aspect of medicine and treatment. And then there's this other side that was loved sitting and, you know, reading Athanasius or arguing about points of Christian theology with my friends. And I thought for years that those two couldn't be reconciled to each other, that they were somehow, you had to choose a life of one or a life of the other.
Yeah.
And I was really grateful to have some wise advisors. Most notably, I think about my dad. My dad's a physician and doesn't have any formal degrees in the humanities, but was always a physician who practiced medicine with a holistic, whole person approach, trying to bring the resources of theology, philosophy, theological anthropology to bear on his patients. And so at one point when I was studying theology and I said, I'm just going to bail on med school, I had a really pivotal conversation with my dad where he, in a really gentle but mature way, directed me that my sense of there being a dichotomy was actually a false sense.
Right. Mm.
There may be a way to integrate those things. And looking back, it's easy to see how I believe the Lord was sort of preparing me for a life and a way of speaking and practicing that integrated those things together. So practicing medicine, again, not merely as a technical set of skills, but as a way of caring for whole persons, which includes thinking about all aspects of their lives, including moral, spiritual lenses on persons,
right.
But then also thinking about ethics from the lens of being a practitioner. And I do think practicing emergency medicine, especially at a place like St. Paul's, is a way of holding one's feet to the fire, testing if your ideas can match what it's like to live and work in difficult situations. So yeah, I'm very grateful for the bringing together of those two things. And
particularly, you say, testing these ideas in this place, in this context. I'm picturing, you know, 4 a.m. in downtown Vancouver, St. Paul's, and the kinds of, like, what people are dealing with when they walk in or are brought in. And to me, and I like this integration or desire for integration, or at some point feeling that there was a lack of that at some point. That's kind of the energy of this book, is how these things come together, what it means to be a medical professional with a theological mind, how the worlds of medicine, addiction, and treatment and theology, and ultimately, like, faith come together. It's who that person is in front of you that you're helping. I'm now thinking in the ER, the ED.
Yeah.
Who that person is, but it's also, like, who you are.
Yeah.
Who you're bringing. So how do you feel those interactions? Like, is there a distinction between kind of the world of church and the world of medicine, and how is that a false distinction?
Yeah, big question. I never meant to write a book about addiction. I think it's one of the funny things about having written a thing, and people now ask me questions sometimes as if I always had this series of opinions, and then I just sort of laid them out in this book.
Yeah.
But really what happened was I got this job that I loved working at St. Paul's, and I just started encountering people, and I felt in my bones that a big part of my role as a person was to be faithful to the things that I witnessed in the lives of those people. One of the things I love about being a Christian is the belief that Christ is the one who sees and treasures all the good and beautiful things about our lives, those things that are often missed or overlooked by others. And that reality is never truer than if you look in neighborhoods like the downtown East Side, where so often if you read the news, it just looks like a bunch of statistics or as if the people themselves are problems. So often we don't have the patience and humility to look and to see the real beauty of neighborhoods like that and of the people who were there. Mm-hmm. And that those things just happened. The story that I tell at the beginning of the book is still the sort of foundational story for my vocation. And that was a story of me sitting at my desk and the nurse asking me to go out to the waiting room to see a patient who came into the department, was to everyone sort of very disorganized. They weren't clear why he was there. And I went out to see him and he was sitting in the waiting room and he looked very disturbing. You know, the other patients mm-hmm. had given him a wide buffer of space. He smelled strongly. He was rocking and moaning and mumbling to himself. And I went and I sat beside him. And before I opened my big mouth to begin speaking, I paused by the Lord's grace to listen to what he was saying. And I heard that he was praying and he was saying to himself over and over again, dear Jesus, I don't need meth. I don't need meth. Mm. Dear Jesus, I don't need meth. And I was just so moved by the intensity of his prayer, his knowledge of his need for God. And I knew that I had encountered something there, not in any way to gloss over the challenges of his life. But again, I was not encountering a problem or a statistic, but a person,
yeah, right.
A neighbor. And so I began writing. I still have this document on my computer that is a document that I called the Horror and Holiness of St. Paul's, which is also the title of the introduction of the book. And I just started writing this series of anecdotes, just sort of very raw things that had happened to me, because I had this sense that these were features of lives that I had a small witness to. I had a small perspective on some of these things that would be easy to overlook. And I had a unique opportunity to see these beautiful things because of my role at St. Paul's. And I felt a desire to be faithful to my friends and my patients by writing them down. And that really was the beginning of the book. And in looking back over those anecdotes, it became apparent to me that addiction was a major theme in them. Mm-hmm. And my wife saw it long before I did in reading them over. But saying that there's a major theme there, and addiction is one of the defining crises of our time, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I do think that the answers that are so commonly on offer are shallow answers. Mm-hmm. And I think some of that is because so often in our conversations, we try to chop people up into little bits. Like you have some people who say addiction is just a problem of a defective will. Some people just love fentanyl for whatever reason. And other people say it's just a problem of diseased neurons. You know, it just, they have this structural brain disease and that's it. Both of those explanations, they miss most of the person. And indeed, they miss most of the parts of the person that are most important to promoting freedom and healing and recovery. Not that the parts of the person they mention are unimportant, but so I had this, again, not intellectual plan, but just burning desire to say something about my patients and my friends that was true and good and beautiful.
Telling the story, the initial story in the book, and in that account, you quote scripture as well. Yeah. He was despised and rejected by others, a man of suffering, acquainted with infirmity, this kind of, there's something in encountering the other person that you're encountering Christ, that there's, and this plays to me so well in the book because it's moving us past some kind of moralistic grid. The person in front of you, and also how you hold this theological vision and your knowledge of scripture, that they are present in that place, in those rooms, in those encounters, in some ways that do many of the things that you just spoke about.
I like how you're outlining kind of like the purpose, like the genesis of this book. And one of the things as I was reading it that I found really helpful was that you unpack, as you've already said, how some of the two kind of models, that either disease or choice, that both of them have like insufficiencies to them. Can you elaborate a little bit on that for us here today to kind of set the stage of like why those don't, in your opinion, actually adequately address like the crisis that you're seeing and encountering?
A big piece of that genesis was seeing patients who had patterns of behavior that I think almost everyone would recognize as addictive. Mm. And then going and looking around for what is actually happening here and working in, you know, the center of excellence for care of people with mm-hmm. addiction, but still finding the conversation pulled between these shallow models where on one hand you have what people call choice models of addiction, mm-hmm. say it's just a problem of the will.
Yeah.
And then on the other extreme, which is much more sort of dogma in medical settings, you have what people call disease or medical or biological models of addiction, which often start from good motivations, not wanting to be judgmental towards the other person, but say they are just the passive victim of a disease that's not significantly different than any other disease. And one thing I found in thinking about this for a long time was that each of them suggested things that I couldn't accept. So the choice model suggested that the person was somehow a bad agent, you know, that they were just some kind of a degenerate, that they, mm-hmm. One encounter that I had that was very moving for me, I cared for a man who was in his early 50s, and he came in, he had a severe alcohol addiction, and I can't remember what the medical issue was, but in trying to get to know him as a person a little bit, I just asked him about the tattoos that he had on his arm. He had two names tattooed on his arm, and he told me, he said, "Oh, those are my children." And I asked him how old his children were, and he said, I can't remember the exact numbers, but he at first said, let's say he said, "Oh, they're 8 and 10. And then he paused for a long moment and he said, "No, that's not right. They're 11 and 13. And then he just started to cry. And the choice model, again, just says he just chose alcohol over his kids because that's what really matters to him. And I found I could not accept that. And I would not accept that for reasons of how I want to view that person. So if the choice model says they're just a bad actor, the disease model wants to escape that conclusion.
Yeah.
I'm with them with that. But the alternative they suggest says that he's not an actor at all, that he's not an agent at all. And that is equally or more depersonalizing, dehumanizing. It places equal or more distance between myself and that person. Mm. And what I want to say is that that person is a potential good actor. He remains an agent. And that the most important factors to promoting his recovery is whole person care. Recovery from addiction isn't just about the right prescription, even though the right prescription might be important and good. It's about his story, his children, his worldview and beliefs, his loves, his gifts, his skills, healing his deep wounds. So there's much, much I could say. I think there's logical problems with each of the models that I won't get into now, but
buy the book, read the book.
Yeah, but I think at the core where I started before I sorted intellectually was again this moral rebellion against the implications of each of the models and the desire to say something different that, yes, made sense of the data points in a better way, but also was loyal to my friends and spoke about my friends in a certain kind of way.
Yeah, I sensed like a kind of frustration in your writing as you're describing the models and the issues that you're seeing with them. I'm not sure if I was correct in that, but I was like, he's very bothered. And when you're talking about that, you have like this like moral issue that you have with it. So if not choice or disease, what do you think is a helpful framework for people to actually approach addiction with?
So in the book, I've outlined a model that I think of as sort of a middle way that I define in the language of a personal model. So the label isn't the important thing, but the important thing I think is to find a middle ground between these extremes. And as you know, so often in our society, conversations can be polarized.
Yeah.
The appeal of polls is that they're simple, right?
Yes.
And that if there's two models and you can identify them, and then you can find a camp to belong to and throw rocks at someone, there's a kind of simplicity that those polls offer. It's always true that inhabiting the middle spaces is more complex sometimes and means wrestling with tension. So what I wanted to do was navigate the middle space between pure choice and pure compulsion, between choice models and disease models. And my other core conviction in calling it a personal model was simply the conviction that addiction is something that happens to whole persons. Again, it's not just a problem of a degenerate will or of a diseased brain. It's a problem of bodies and minds and spirits. And so there's a few things I say in the book, but one of the really important moves, I think, that's quite simple, is that addiction is usually a way of looking for things that are good. It's a way of looking for moral and spiritual goods. And this, again, gets obscured in all the language of recreational drug use. One of the important things to see, of course, recreational drug use is a real thing. But when we're talking about addiction, addiction is not about recreation. It's about joy and healing and peace and belonging and courage and moral and spiritual goods, things that all of us want and need. And I did a bunch of reading that helped me here, but I began with my patients. If you ask people who are addicted to fentanyl, what does fentanyl feel like or why? Like, you ask them the why question. Again, the disease model orients us away from the why question because it just says it's just a pathological behavior. Yeah. There's no relatability there. But if you ask them the why question, people say fentanyl feels like a hug. It feels like falling asleep in your mother's bed when you're a child. It feels like someone wrapping their arms around you when you're out in the cold. One of my patients, this person knows that I'm a Christian. He said to me, he said, "You don't understand. It feels like God is in your lungs."
Wow.
I think we should be attentive to these kinds of answers. We should hear them humbly, as seeing their use of fentanyl as a way of looking for moral and spiritual goods, and then having, again, the clarity to say fentanyl addiction is not good because it doesn't work.
At least not long term. It might in that moment, but the destructive qualities are also there.
And so, again, I think even that moves beyond the sort of judgmental looking down on the person, placing distance from them. It says, this person is a person like me. They fundamentally want and need the same kinds of things as me because they have the same kind of God-given nature as me. Like me, sometimes they seek the right things in the wrong places, or they seek the right things in disordered or misordered ways. But like me, there's hope for them.
I love the way that you approach this complicated issue in a complicated way. I'm curious about how that ends up working out, you know, when you're in the ED, not even just for you, but for potentially other doctors. Like, are you guys, in one sense, do you have like the resources and the time to actually take this sort of approach?
I think that we do.
Okay.
And that's a big claim. Again, I work in one of those sort of busiest emergency departments around, and definitely there's pressure on our time. But I do think that the building blocks of a personal model is what it suggests at base is a certain way we can approach people. Those things can be applied over the course of short interactions, or they can be applied over the course of longer interactions. And I think one of the things I think everybody needs is good friends. Again, putting people with addiction in the same box as everyone else. All of us in our growth towards good need good friends. So I would never pretend that, you know, my work in the emergency department, my short encounter with the patient replaces or can fill the role of someone, you know, who's a lifelong friend. But all of us also need moments of mercy and grace that can come from unexpected places. And one of my self-talk points, one of the things I frequently say to myself on shift is, how do I offer this person a gift across interacting with them? How can I offer them some gift of hospitality, kindness, generosity, something that's felt by them, not just as this person doing their job, this professional asking me these questions because they have to? Yeah. How can I creatively find a way to do something that is felt by them as something that is motivated by kindness or grace or respect? And I think we can do that over the course of short interactions in emergency departments and on street corners and the person who wanders in the lobby of a church or whatever it is.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, and I picked it up right away in response to Allison's question when you said, I think we can do this. In my many years being a pastor, there's something that is really resonating with me here, and it is that word personal, that there is, and I have found that the interaction doesn't have to be long. If I go in motivated to actually connect with the person, like on a personal level, and there's a faith motivation for me in this as well, how I encounter God's presence. And then I can see people responding in a way that, oh, there's actually a human being connecting with me here. They see me, or they're wanting to at least. And so when you use the term personal model, I'm hearing not only personal model in how you see the person, but that you are allowed to be who you are, not merely a professional. I mean, we've talked a lot in some on this podcast and other work that we do to medical professionals, the head of ICU, psychologists, others, about how in the last number of years, and Kalanithi in his book picks up on this as well, the new ministers are doctors, right? And so there is something in this that, like, being able to be fully a person, and we would say, like, created in the image of God, these kinds of things. So from that, I wanted to move to, and I think it's probably, you know, your intended audience. It's not that long ago that churches, many churches, and maybe some still are, were really, really in the choice model, right? Like addiction was sinister
model.
And
Definitely.
Sinful, kind of like those were the really bad people kind of thing. And there's been a lot of movement there for most churches and congregations, right? That so I can see that some of your intended audience are people who are familiar with church, some people who are familiar with scripture. You reference scripture and Bible stories. You talk about what the Bible has to say about addiction. Tell us about those parts of the book and why they're important.
Yeah. One of the things in deciding to write the book, me and my wife chatted quite a bit about how there were two potentially different projects that were here. Part of me was drawn towards writing a book, think sort of Gabor Mate, like the physician who is writing based on close encounters with patients, building in a variety of resources, but writing not from and to a particular worldview perspective. I think that's one of the things that's appealing about Gabor Mate, is that he's a well-read guy. He pulls from all kinds of different resources, and people with a variety of different worldviews can read and engage with him. I felt over time, and I feel happy I made this decision, to not take that approach and to instead write as a Christian, primarily to other Christians, although I believe, and I've been grateful to hear, you know, feedback from people that, you know, some of the arguments of the book are very intelligible and appealing to many who aren't Christians. And I'm grateful for engagement from those listeners and readers as well. But I did feel compelled as a Christian to speak in a distinctly Christian way, not just good anthropology or holistic anthropology, but theological anthropology that looks, when we say what is a human being, we say Jesus Christ is the true human being, Jesus Christ across all ages and stages of human life. And the reason we can know that our patients have dignity and that we owe them respect is because Christ has dignity. We owe him our respect as the true human being. Mother Teresa, you know, would tell her nuns when they went to care for patients, say to yourself, here comes Jesus in his most distressing disguise. So the dignity of the person is not grounded in anything they can do or any of their behavior, but the dignity of the person is grounded in the incarnation. That's a claim that's grounded in obviously a particular tradition, which is my tradition. And so I'm happy to have written and spoken from a distinctly Christian point of view. Obviously, doing that means talking about the Bible. And the Bible, of course, does not include the term addiction. And there's no single term in the Bible that has a simply synonymous meaning with the word addiction. I think that leads many Christians to be perplexed or not sure of how we come to the Bible with our questions about addiction. Again, this perplexity is furthered by the dominance of the medical model. So I agree that most Christians who I know aren't simple sort of choice model people. They want more nuanced models.
Yeah.
But often they're told that addiction is a medical problem. It's not a moral problem. And then they say, well, I guess then it's kind of not our turf. It's not turf that the Bible can speak to or the Christian communities can speak to. I think that's one of the unintended negative effects of broad acceptance of the disease model. One really informative essay for me is a paper that was given by Carl Bart called The Strange World of the Bible.
Oh, strange. Yeah. Yeah, oh,
yeah, was it The Strange New World
you're
of the Bible?
His
yeah, I know
it
well.
But he
amazing.
He talks about how so often we come to the Bible with our own questions, our own biases, and the Bible is big enough, magnanimous enough to meet us there. But really what it's doing all the time is pulling us into its world, which is to say the real world, the world of God. And when we take the time to be humble and to really listen, the Bible pulls us into what is real. And that's been my experience with thinking about addiction in the Bible. Is at first, when people ask me about the Bible and the addiction, a Bible in the category of addiction, I myself struggled to find areas of overlap. But the more I simply took the time to listen, the more I've come to believe. And almost every week, my wife gets annoyed with me sometimes because almost every week during the sermon at church, I'm like, oh, this is about addiction too. I don't mean about addiction in a like a narrow one-to-one direct sense.
Yeah.
Or as if the intent of the authors was to write about this modern category called addiction. Of course not. But when we take the time to really listen, I believe we can find the Bible to be the ground of almost everything we need to say about addiction and about persons with addiction. And in the book, as you know, I give a couple of examples. Mm-hmm. One of them is the example of the Gerasene man, which might sound provocative.
Gerasene demoniac. It just sounds, yeah.
If it's provocative to people who haven't read the chapter, it's partly intentionally so to try to show sometimes if we say, oh, we should never apply that text to addiction, I think it's worth teasing apart. Why do we have that never? Why do we feel so strongly? And probably there's some good motivation there. We really don't want to, in a simple one-to-one way, equate addiction to demon possession. And I would agree with you. But if that good motivation prevents you from listening to the text, then you've also missed a wonderful opportunity. And if we, as I've described in the book, really just listen to what that text says, I think it helps us in really beautiful and pragmatic ways in terms of caring for our neighbors with addiction.
Awesome.
You name a couple of, I think, my favorite story. I think the stories were my favorite part of the book.
That's going to be true for a lot of people.
I know, like they're full of. There's a lot of humor in them. Surprisingly, I did not expect coming to the book to laugh in some parts of it. And I think that speaks to kind of your approach of wanting to take a holistic and like a whole person view of this, and that like, you know, people who are struggling with addiction are not purely sad, are not purely like that they have joy and happiness. I think my favorite story is the one that you titled The Wedding at Cana. Would you mind maybe giving a bit of a rundown of that one and why in particular you included that in your book?
I'm so happy you asked. It might be my favorite story in some way as well. It's such a St. Paul story, but I was working in Fast Track, which is the area of our department that's supposed to be for sort of small and easy problems, and it very rarely.
You just know as soon as it's named that.
Is there ever a small and easy problem?
But I was at work in emergency departments. We have a triage system. So the sickest patients are level 1 and the least sick patients are level 5. And usually in Fast Track, it's mostly level 4s and 5s with some 3s thrown in there. So when a level 2 comes to Fast Track, it's, you know, a bit notable. So I was working an evening and there was a level 2 that came in, and in the triage nurse wrote in her comments, level 2 for pain. So there's a note that the patient was in very severe pain. So I went out, you could spot the patient immediately. He was sitting there with his wife, and the triage note said that he had zipped the foreskin of his penis into the zipper of his pants.
That's very problematic.
Yes, so a big problem. But he was quite intoxicated. He's a guy who we knew quite well at St. Paul's, had a severe alcohol addiction. He was drunk, and the story went that he was sort of with some friends and he was telling them a story, and he really was in the middle of his great story. He had tried to have a quick pee, but he was just too rushed to come back, tried to zip up a zipper and zipped the skin of his penis into this thing. So I brought him into a bay, and one piece of medical minutia that your listeners never thought they would get from this podcast. It's actually quite easy to freeze a penis. So like some parts of the body are difficult to put freezing in. A penis is quite easy. So anyway, so I put in some freezing, and prior to that, he was just like swearing and super mad. But then within a minute or two, he was had no pain. And then he was back into the more sort of jovial mode. So he's teasing me, and his wife and him are bantering in quite a lovely way. In Fast Track, again, the patients are quite close together. So then these other patients who are around start to poke their heads in because they're interested. And a lot of these patients are from the Downtown East Side. And the patient is totally trying to bring them all in and show them. And I'm trying to, like, amazing, you know, draw the curtains. And, yep, and I'm like the hall monitor who's totally ruining their good time. I try.
It's a group project.
Yeah. One thing leads to another, and I, you know, cut off most of the pants and then start working to cut through the bar of the zipper. And his wife tried to take the tools away from me, and then he wouldn't let her. So again, this really beautiful chaos. And like you say, the story of persons with addiction is not all sadness. The addiction is contrary to the good, but the people are lovely. And so anyway, so I had to go interpret there was a critical blood work result. So a nurse came over and she started working with the tools, and I went back to my computer. And then a few minutes later, I hear this cheering, and there's this moment of jubilee in Fast Track, you know, where all these guys are cheering. And again, the other patients are trying to come into this guy's room, and they're offering him their pants because his pants got cut apart. And I feel such an affection for those patients. And mm-hmm. what I really want is to belong among them. Like, wow. I want to be one of them, even as, again, I sometimes have to be the one who tells them, like, please don't shout about penises too loudly in this shared
don't keep inviting people to the party here.
but one of the things that I've felt, and I'm grateful that you brought up this story, one of the significant things to me about titling that story The Wedding at Cana is a belief that my affection for my patients isn't just that affection for people who are endearing for one reason mm-hmm. or another, that those moments are morally significant. And the joy of those ordinary people in these very strange moments is significant. And, you know, the first miracle of Christ in the Gospel of John is the Wedding of Cana, where Christ comes to bless these poor people, so poor they didn't even have enough wine for a wedding, you know, not the elegant celebrations of the highest people in the world, but like the normal wedding where some people were having too much to drink of peasants in a forgotten corner of the world. And how much like high artistry there was at that wedding, who knows? But the point is, God comes to join us in all of life, to bless us for our ordinary joys, and even our joys that are that are strange. And so, part of what I felt in caring for people at places like St. Paul's is that the joy of a moment like that isn't just funny, even though it is funny. It's also morally significant. And in the incarnation, Christ blesses us for moments like that. Wow. And indeed, joins us at moments like that.
Yeah. It's a beautiful, beautiful picture. And I mean, I keep having in my mind this whole conversation, this desire to see the person as a person, and these two models, the choice model and the disease model, how the personal model offers this connection that, as you say, the disease model is just as and often more dehumanizing, like paternalistic. And
yeah,
and this picture you give is the opposite of that, this enjoyment of humanity, mm-hmm. this and even your desire to be kind of part of the party. So I want to end by asking a theological question, or asking a question that we often ask at the end of our conversations, but in a theological manner. We ask people like, what gives you hope? I was going to ask you like, what does healing look like? But to some degree, you just described it to me in that, in that image. So to ask it in theological terms, what does a hopeful eschatological vision look like to you in terms of like, that's a what is healing question. What's hopeful eschatology to you in terms of some of the things you write about?
Yeah. Another wonderful question. I was just this morning, I was just in the sauna with my kids actually. And we were reading, it was very early in the morning, but we were reading Colossians 1. And Paul, in talking about Jesus, he says he is the start of the beginning of it all, firstborn from the realms of the dead, so in all things he might be the chief, for in him all the fullness was glad to dwell, and through him to recognize all things to himself, making peace through the blood of the cross. Through him, yes, things on earth and also the things in the heavens. And I so often, not that this is always the intent, but when I've heard the gospel preached, it sounds like people are saying the good news is just that God is going to save some disembodied souls out of this bad world to some disembodied other place. But Paul says, not just in Colossians, but elsewhere, Christ has come to reconcile all things to himself. And the gospel of Jesus Christ is not just about saving some non-physical souls out of this big bad world. It is about rescuing and redeeming and reconciling all things to the one through and for whom all things were made. And I have such hope for my friends and for my patients because of Christ, who is the one who sees and knows and loves them far better than we ever could, but who takes our small acts of charity and kindness and makes them part of his healing of the world through grace.
Thank you so much for that hopeful picture, I would say faithful picture in terms of theological vision that obviously we share. I want to just say thank you to you at the end here by identifying another aspect of the book. That's the italicized portions of the book. Some of those are the stories, but the italicized portions also include your crying out to God. This is a book on theology and medicine and recovery and personhood, but that includes your own prayer, your own longing that you carry in these places. And I'm really grateful that you included that there. It helped me to see you in those rooms, whether it's, you know, teaching in a theological school or helping someone in a little bay at St. Paul's. And I'm really, really grateful for that, that crying out and that longing is as much a part of you and what you do as your expertise and your training, and all of those things that really, really matter. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us. We're just grateful for the time and for what you've done in this book. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Rector's Cupboard is a production of Reflector Project and is hosted and produced by Todd Weeb, Allison Williams, and Amanda Mina. Our Cupboard Master is Ken Bell. Rector's Cupboard is made possible by the generous support of donors. Check out rectorscupboard.ca for past episodes, events, and how you can help fund the podcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, which helps other people find us. Thanks for listening.